Talk given Sunday, 6th May 1973. By virtue of our own constitution, and the whole socio-cultural influence around us throughout our lives, we are conditioned to deal with all that is finite, limited, mortal. Every person, every situation, every event, every object, every realization, achievement, is always a conditional achievement or realization or person or thing. It depends upon so many other factors around. So that the mind becomes accustomed to think only in terms of finitude, of limitation, of mortality. But there is that in us which has this extraordinary urge towards the immortal, the infinite. And the unfortunate thing is that we are taught by our parents, our teachers, those who are in authority in the sphere of organized religion, to think about God, or the infinite, or the immortal, or the eternal. Now our entire thinking process is a conditioned and conditional process. And quite unconsciously, as well as consciously, we attempt to think about these transcendent realities in the same manner as we think of the conditioned and the mortal. That is why whatsoever we think about God or transcendence is invariably wrong. Because the whole thinking mechanism is in terms of limitation, of conditionality. We have no capacity to imagine or think or talk about the unconditioned, the non-finite, the immortal. But the extraordinary thing about us human beings is that it is a fact, not merely a possibility, but an achieved in the past and today attainable, achievable fact that we can experience the totality, although we can never state anything about it. We can be in that condition of utter communion with the ultimate real, with this infinite, this unconditioned, and be affected by that experience for the rest of our life. And yet, we can never communicate it in any finite terms whatsoever. We cannot hand over the reality. But our words, our thoughts, our feelings about it, maybe a gesture, maybe a ritual, maybe a symbol, could be of such a nature that it could stimulate the other person if he or she happens to have some receptive sensitivity, and provided the symbol or the word is the right kind of word or symbol. See, one of the great things we forget when we start talking about matters transcendent is that transcendence has no dimensions. Whereas all that we deal with, all that lies within our experience, has a specific number of dimensions, whether they be of space or time or whatever they may be. And therefore there is limitation. Therefore there is a beginning, a proceeding, and an ending, a birth and a death. And our minds, as they are quite incapable of raising up any pattern which is dimensionless. And in fact, our minds as they are will always be incapable of that. But that inner depth of the mind, which is an extraordinary sensitivity, which does function within us, can thrill to the ultimate, to the infinite. Although it remains as a thrill which transforms us, but yet can never be compressed into any particular shape or form. If we appreciate this, we will appreciate the tremendous significance of silence. Silence means precisely this. Now there's another aspect to it to bear in mind at the same time. The silence in itself is dimensionless. The personal realization in ultimate communion of transcendence is also dimensionless. But all dimensions, all that is limited, is subsumed within that dimensionless. Let us take a simple physical analogy. And we must beware when we use analogies, because analogies very easily mislead. We know what any solid object is like. It's three-dimensional. It has length, it has breadth, it has depth. So you've got your three dimensions at right angles to each other and all the rest of it, and we can deal with solid objects. Now, because we are capable of being conscious spatially in terms of three dimensions, we are also equally at home with what is two-dimensional, a flat surface. We make a drawing on a flat surface, and we know exactly what that drawing is supposed to stand for, except in the case of some painters in our own day and so forth. You can draw a straight line, which is only one-dimensional. We can even go to the extent of conceiving the point which has no dimensions, but which represents one aspect of mathematical infinity. The immeasurable. You can't measure a point. No length, no breadth, no depth, no mass, no weight, no anything about it. So you see, the dimensional is subsumed in the dimensionless. That is our actual experience, even physically. Now, this, if seen in terms of the context of the religious consciousness, could enable us, could help us to get a feel of transcendence itself. Now, I've said all this introductorily in order that we may appreciate how difficult it is for us to study the old scriptures and understand the deeper, the real meanings of some of the things that you find in these scriptures. Those people, several thousand years ago, when they produced the great scriptures, the Old Testament, the Vedas, the Upanishads, the Avesta of the Zarathustrians, and so on, when they produced those, there was no modern science, there were no developed intellectual, logical systems of philosophy. Their awareness of existence was in the religious mode. They were religious sensitivities and religious perceptions, which they expressed in the language of their times. Therefore, the whole mental process was such that it was quite different from our mental processes, because we are conditioned in a totally different way. And so the words they used, although you can find a linguistic equivalent for those old words, nevertheless had a content of meaning which quite escapes us, unless we release from within ourselves, especially through deep meditation, that sensitivity of mind which may perhaps enable us to wake up to what those old meanings might have been. If we realize this, we will see that so much of the scriptural writings of the past, read literally today, reads like gibberish. What on earth did they mean? Sounds like a heap of nonsense. But it is not at all nonsensical if one's sensitivities are sufficiently awakened to penetrate into that inner meaning, even in some small measure. Now, let me first quote something which the Buddha said. The Brahman whose nature is unsinful, not harsh, unstained, self-restrained, who has mastered knowledge and fully traversed the Brahma path, the holy life. He rightly, a Brahman, ought to announce the Brahma word, to use the theistic phrase, the word of God. He who has no self-obtrusiveness in the world. Now I want to take this phrase, who has mastered knowledge. In the Pali, the word is Vedantagu. He who has gone anta to the end Veda of the Vedas. Vedantagu. He who has gone to the end of the Vedas. The whole of the Vedic knowledge of the day. Because that was his background. The greatest of the Upanishads also had already come into being. In addition to the hymns of the Rig Veda, the Sama, the Yajur and the Atharva Vedas, they had preceded the Buddha by at least 1,000 to 1,500 years, those hymns. And the greatest of the Upanishads had preceded him by at least a century as far as their compilation was concerned. The oral teaching must have preceded him by several centuries. Now the Buddha was talking about this knowledge when he used that term Vedantagu. We get some idea of what this knowledge is as far as the Upanishadic record goes. In the Chandogya Upanishad, in that very famous conversation between Narada, who went to the Holy One, Sanat Kumara, for instruction. Narada was a great sage, and there's an enormous amount of literature about him, especially in later Hinduism, in the Puranas and such writings. Now the name Sanat Kumara means the ever virgin youth. And the Buddha himself uses that term, Sanam Kumara, when he is talking of Brahma, the Father God, who is the Creator. He who represents the creative power of the world, of the universe. Or rather, shall I put it this way, it's the name which represents that creative power. Now you see, you get the divine dialogue form presented in the Upanishad, just as you find the divine dialogue form utilized in the Old Testament. The prophets are moved by the Spirit of the Lord, or the angel of the Lord speaks through them, and so forth. So now Sanat Kumara is the name used for the teacher who gives the instruction to Narada. Narada goes and asks him, tells him, teach me, sir, about the ultimate reality. And Sanat Kumara, the ever virgin youth, very significant, complete innocence. The stage of complete innocence, of complete purity, is represented there. Perfection. Sanat Kumara says, you tell me what you know, and I will tell you further. So Narada gives the recital of what he knows, and it is just this one verse we shall examine today. I'll read you the English translation as it stands, and this is a translation by Radhakrishnan. And I specially mention this fact because he is an Indian, and Indian scholars translate into English in the same way as Western scholars have translated into English. They use the same translation, with perhaps a slight alteration of a word here or there. You'll soon see the significance of why I say this. Narada says, Venerable Sir, I know all the four Vedas, the epic, and the ancient lore, the Veda of the Vedas, and within brackets, as an explanatory remark by modern translators, they put in, that is, grammar. The Veda of the Vedas. Grammar, they call it. Propitiation of the fathers, the ancestors. The science of numbers, and within brackets, mathematics. The science of portents, the science of time, and within brackets, chronology. The science, logic, ethics, and politics. The science of the gods, the science of sacred knowledge, the science of elemental spirits, the science of weapons, astronomy, the science of serpents and the fine arts. This, venerable sir, I knew. Now, of course, the tendency, quite naturally, of the well-trained scholar is to think of these in modern terms, mathematics, logic, polity, ethics, and all the rest of it, you see, like we have today. But now let us take the original words in the Sanskrit and see if we can't get behind these illusory translations in certain cases. Let's take the word pitriam, which is translated as the propitiation of the fathers. Propitiation is a bad word. This comes about because of the work, and splendid work it is in its own way, done by modern anthropology. And the idea that the spirits of the ancestors had to be appeased, and so forth. The word is pitriam, and these are the people of India have observed rites in honor of the ancestors and progenitors. Rites in honor of the ancestors and progenitors. Now, who were these ancestors and progenitors? As far as the holy ones themselves were concerned. As far as the populace was concerned, it's like the anthropologists say, they perform a ceremony, it's about my late father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and so on. Now, just forget all the biological ancestors and progenitors. These progenitors are archetypal images of the different stages through which humanity went in the process of its evolution from its primordial beginnings. Now, in the Upanishads, you have long lists of names concerned with them. Not so much in the Upanishads, because here you have the line of teachers in the Upanishads. But in the Puranas, you have long lists of names. And the ordinary reader thinks of these names as representing human beings. John Smith, William Brown, and so on and so on. Now, consider what you find in Genesis. You find, for example, in chapter 5, a list of the patriarchs, starting with Adam. Remember, Adam is supposed to be created by God. And in St. Luke's Gospel, when the genealogy of Jesus is traced, in St. Luke's Gospel, it goes all the way up to Adam, which was, they say which was, they don't say who was, which was the Son of God. Now, you take that list, and you come down, Adam, Seth, Enosh, and Mahalalel, and all those names, till you come to Enoch, who is number 7, and you go on to finally to Noah, who is number 10, I believe, and that exhausts that list. Now, these were not live personages as you and I are. They are symbolic representations of archetypal images of the different stages of man's development throughout his evolution. And it is not just the biological evolution that is involved here, but his spiritual evolution. They represent the play of cosmic energies and the different stages which emerged in process of time through the play of these timeless, infinite cosmic energies. The new possibilities that came into being, these are the real ancestors and progenitors. Now, this is how, remember, the religious consciousness saw the evolution, the emergence of man. And that is what they represent. And so the Pythrium refers to the rites in honor of the ancestors and the progenitors, the patriarchs, or whatever word you like to use. It is not a propitiation of the fathers in terms of the simple ceremonies which people have all over the world. You know, the Chinese have ancestor worship and so on and so on. It's not that. This is its inner meaning. And why must one express a sense of reverence for it all? Because the sense of reverence expresses one's understanding of the nature of these cosmic energies and how they have been responsible for the emergence of our psycho-mental and spiritual nature and faculties. And if one does not reverence the faculty which you are gifted with, then you will misuse it. You take the case of a great artist. A man is born with a gift for poetry, we'll say, or for painting or music or whatever it is. He reverences that gift and he brings it to fruition. If he doesn't reverence that gift, he will probably misuse it, he will debase it. Hence the necessity for this reverence and the expression of that reverence. Take the next word, Rashim. Which is translated as the science of numbers and in brackets mathematics. Now forget the mathematics part of it. There was no necessity to go to the perfected Holy One in those days even, to learn that 2 plus 2 equals 4. That your parents and those around you taught you. The science of numbers. And what is this science of numbers? This science of numbers is a science which is associated also with letters of the alphabet. You find both in the Kabbalistic teaching as well as in the original Vedic teaching, this statement that the scripture, the Old Testament in the case of the Judaic tradition, the Vedas and Upanishads, but particularly the four Vedas, the hymns, the Rig, Sama, Yajur and Atharva Veda, were the product, were produced by Brahma, God himself. And in the Old Testament, that original, the first five books, the Torah, and particularly Genesis, is ascribed to God himself. It's the word of God. Now, each letter of the alphabet was associated with number, with a number. In the case of the Hebrew alphabet, the first nine letters are 1 to 9. The next nine letters are 10, 20, associated with 10, 20 to 90. And then 18 and 4. And the next four letters, which brings you up to 22, are associated with 100, 200, 300, 400. And then of some of these letters, five of them, they have what is called their final forms, which were associated with 500, 600, 700, 800, 900. So you got 27 in that way. Now, each of these letters of the alphabet, and a similar thing, but not quite so developed, applies to the Vedic and Sanskrit letters. Though, as I said, not quite so developed as in the Kabbalah. Each of these letters and numbers represented some deep metaphysical concept expressing the way in which cosmic energies worked. This is the important point. Those of you who have studied classics in your university days will know how in the school of Pythagoras and so forth there was this science of numbers taught, and the different numbers were associated with deep ideas. But we must bear in mind that it is not only the ideas, because they could be just impotent strings of words in the brain. They actually stand for real energies at play. Now we come to another point. If you take the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, we have A, B, C, D, E, F, G, etc. But if you take the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, they are, with just three or four exceptions, all complete names and words in themselves composed of the letters of the alphabet. The first letter is Aleph. But listen to the sound of Aleph. You've got the A itself, you've got the La sound, and so on. The next one is Beit, the next is Gimel, the next is Dalet, and so forth. So you see, each of these letters is a complete proper name. Now, if you take Genesis, and Genesis is a very good example for this, the very first word of Genesis is Bereshit. Loosely, somewhat misleadingly translated as in the beginning. It is better to translate it as out of the unknown origin, for its colloquial meaning. But Bereshit is made up of Beit, Resh, Yod, Ashen, Tav. You see, there are so many letters involved in it. And each of the letters has its number system, number attached. And each of the numbers stands for cosmic energy and the way it will play. So out of that single word, Bereshit, you get not just one meaning, but you get a whole world evolving out of it. You get it. And this is associated with the numbers. This was their science of numbers. Nothing to do with 2 plus 2 or 100 new pence make a pound. But you see, we get misled when we just make linguistic equations when translating the old scriptures. Because the old scriptures hid their inner esoteric knowledge in this particular code. Now, if you look at the Indian presentation of this, those of you who are interested in yoga particularly, and who have read books on yoga, you will recollect that with the different chakras, as they are called, the different centers of psychical energy, starting from the base of the spine and going right up to the brain, the seven centers, different vowels and consonants of the Sanskrit alphabet are associated with each of the chakras. Now, if those sounds are properly intoned, and the same would apply in the Kabbalistic teaching, if they are properly intoned, rightly intoned, they have an actual physical effect upon you. Not only a psychological effect, a psychical effect, but a physical effect also, as well as an effect which wakes up the inner depths of the mind and makes you sensitive to things which are beyond human ken in the ordinary way. This is the meaning of the word mantra, the magic spell. The real meaning of the word mantra. But when you intone this, you have to have your mind properly concentrated upon it. You have to attend to it fully. And all this is implied and involved in this science of numbers, Rashim. Popularly and misleadingly called mathematics. Then we have this word Daivam, which is translated as the science of portents, or as augury. Now, I've put down here the science of the nature and functioning of the devas. I think all of you know the word deva. It is the Indian word, which is usually translated by God. The devas are the gods, as we call them. All the personages of the different pantheons, the Rig Vedic, the Avastan, the Greek, the Teutonic, Celtic, and so forth, all the pantheons have their gods and goddesses and so forth. They are the devas. Now, the word deva is derived from div, the root div, which means to shine, to stand out. Therefore, it represents excellence, perfection, power. And it also is associated with for instance, the Latin do, dare, dedi, datum, dare, to give, the giver. God is the shining one, the supremely shining one. And God is the giver. And the gods are supposed to be the givers. Now, who are these gods? What are these gods? Do they exist as entities floating about in space? Not a bit of it. When you yourself enter the deeper states of consciousness, and especially when you enter the states which the Buddha, for instance, called entering upon and abiding in the infinity of Akasha and of Vijnana, of space and of consciousness, discriminative consciousness. And then there are the other deeper states, which we need not talk about at the moment. But when you enter into these deep states, you have gone right beyond the limitations of dimensions in which we ordinarily function. You are not discriminatively conscious of what you are in that state, but you are actually aware by being infinity. There is no finitude present in that state. Awareness being, which is the non-finite, the unlimited, the immortal. There is no beginning to it, there is no ending to it, there is no proceeding in it, because that would all imply dimensions. In that state, you are in harmony with these transcendent cosmic energies. When you come back to ordinary sense, discursive mind consciousness, discriminative consciousness, and the ordinary activities of the mind as we experience them here and now, day after day, if you remain quite quiet for a long time, not a few minutes, hours, days, the holy ones, when they went right into the profoundest states of consciousness and came back, just stayed put for several days at a stretch, completely quiet, undisturbed. In that state, that which was realized in that profound state of consciousness slowly takes shape as thought and is formulated as so many words. This word, these words, are words which can be rightly called prophetic speech. If spoken by him who has himself realized in some degree or other, and if listened to with pure attention, without the mind chattering back at what is being said, then the person who is listening is inspired in such a manner that he himself experiences a unity with the transcendent real, with the play of cosmic energies. Now, the forms There are several forms in which this cosmic energy plays through us. We express these forms by language of this type, at least I use it. I use the terms transcendent love or wisdom, or beauty, or goodness, and so forth. What other words of the language can I use? You see? And in the great pantheons, you have the different gods representing these things, don't you? Zeus represents this, Athena represents that, Apollo represents this. I'm using the Greek pantheon because you're perhaps best acquainted with that, and with the names of the archangels like Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, Uriel, Samael, and all of them. You see, and what they stand for. So this one and only ultimate cosmic energy, when it comes through into manifestation in the world of form and matter, manifests along certain outstanding lines. These are the great gods. And Daivam is the science of the nature and function of the great gods. Now, as I have tried to present it, it's so difficult to talk about these things. These different forms, as represented by the names of the gods of the pantheons, correspond to patterns of our own human nature, of events, and all sorts of things in the physical world itself. He who can penetrate into the relationships between the transcendent pattern and the earthly pattern can foretell the reading of the signs, the omens, the portents. The science of augury really stands for that. But who are the men or women who really have that capacity? It would take the perfected Holy One himself, who really has grown to this extent, flowered out to this extent, who can do this rightly. You will find hints of this, for instance, in the discourses of the Buddha. Time and again, the Buddha advises the disciple, perhaps this is not the right time to do it. Perhaps you ought to take the right-hand path there instead of turning to the left. I mean, in physical matters. And if the disciple somehow or other follows what the Buddha has said, he is all right. And when he doesn't, he suffers physical accident, even death. It's there in the writings, you read them. The Buddha, the enlightened one, could see this and convey it. And in the writings in India, there are innumerable instances given of this sort of power which the perfected Holy One has. So there's the science of augury, the science of portents, the reading of the signs and the omens, is not something to be rejected out of hand. We know, for example, the phenomenon of dowsing, don't we? And it works out far more frequently, correctly, than would be warranted by the mathematical laws of chance and probability. Number of times the people are correct is rather greater than that. And modern experimental research into these different sensitivities, these psychical sensitivities which people have shows. This research shows that there is this something. But this something, taken to its perfection, is the real meaning of this word daivam. Narada knows all this. And I'll associate this with something which he says later on, which is called deva vidyang, which is the knowledge of the gods. So it means, I have put down here, a knowledge of the archetypal energies and their personifications. We won't bother with that. It takes too much time to explain this in detail. We'll go on. Nidhim is translated as chronology. Let's leave chronology out. Some have said it stood for history. But I rather doubt whether these people meant history in that sense. This chronology is a different thing. Well, I'll give you the hint since I've whetted your appetite, I trust. You know, the universal process is a most extraordinary thing. It's an extraordinarily complex thing. It's not a simple cycle. You see, you start here and you go on and you end there. It sort of wheels within wheels, cycles within cycles, lesser cycles involved within the greater cycles, and all of them having a complex but a complete and a perfect relationship with each other. This is something which we don't know about in modern times in the way that they did in their times. And this is the chronology referred to. This time is not just a unidirectional thing, dependent wholly upon our mode of consciousness, our mode of perception of the rotation of the earth on its own axis and its revolution around the sun. Our whole time concept and our mental conditioning where time is concerned is dependent upon those two fundamental facts. You see, and it is very nearly 100%, very nearly 100% mechanical. But there is this other thing, rhythm. And rhythm doesn't move in a straight line like that. It is all a three-dimensional dance of movement. They understood chronology in that way too. A great mystery. Then the other word, vako vakyam, which is translated as logic. I rather doubt whether Narada and Sanat Kumara thought in terms of logic. Logic is an ordinary dictionary meaning, if you like. But take it literally. Vako vakyam, the word of the word. And I rather feel that what Narada meant was the original Veda, which was orally transmitted. This is what he knew. The Vedas as written, which have come down to us through 3,500 years are only fragments, the external forms, and the meanings that we know with regard to the hymns of the Vedas are just linguistic equations. That original hidden meaning, without the knowledge of the Rashim, the science of numbers and letters, we don't know. It's not in print. So, Vako Vakyam, I'd like to translate as the original Veda. Then there is another word he uses, Ekayanam. And this is translated as ethics and politics here. The literal meaning is the one and only way to do things. Ekayanam, the one and only way to do things. Now remember that the context of all this is the religious context. Obviously, they were not thinking in terms of international relationships or economic problems or anything like that. And in those days, they didn't exist like they exist today. The one and only way to do things. Here is Narada wanting to realize the ultimate reality, Brahman, eternal God. Is he going to bother about politics and all that sort of stuff? No. The one and only way to do things. How do we do things? Impelled by necessity, by desire, by ambition, compelled by circumstance. And so, we do things in this, that, or the other way, under all those influences, and we try to do them in a manner which will bring us satisfaction, pleasure, success, happiness, according to our definitions of those words. Therefore, the way in which I, the ordinary human, do things is in almost all cases the wrong way. I make a mess. It is the mercy of God, it is the beneficence of life that keeps me going. And in my conceit I imagine I did this, I did the other, I produced this, I did that, and so forth. This is how I do things. What then is the one and only way to do things in the religious sense? One can put it very briefly and simply. Be completely sensitive. Let the mind and the heart be completely quiet, free of the intrusion of desire, of ambition, free of everything that springs up from within one which obtrudes itself upon the world around. Be sensitive that way, fully awake, and let things happen. That doesn't mean you are supine and entirely passive. Because in the letting things happen, if the mind truly sees the whole situation as it actually is, the body will perform just the necessary action in the best possible way that your body is capable of doing it. It's the one and only way to do things. Let them happen. Out goes all conceit, all egoism, all vanity, all selfishness. This is in the religious context, surely. So that's ekayanam. Just one or two other things I'll touch, not the whole lot. Well, just one we'll touch. There is, Narada has the kshatra vidya. Now, kshatra means power. The handling of power. And you know, I've said over and over again, that power is invariably and inevitably misused unless there is the harmony of love and wisdom. Both come to flower. Then we use power rightly. Now the power which he refers to here is, of course, the power which emerges out of the innermost depths of the mind. He knows the theoretical aspect of it, the kshatra vidya. He also has great actual abilities. Because if you read the Puranas, you will see the extraordinary things Narada can do. He knows all this, but, says Narada, he has not realized the Atma, therefore he is the sorrowing one. And therefore he comes to Sanat Kumara for this further instruction. Now this is all, part of what is implied in this phrase, the knowledge of the Vedas. And the Buddha says, he who has gone to the end of the knowledge of Vedas, he, rightly a Brahman, may speak the word of God, the word of truth.